Well, good morning. I'm Rich Jeffries. I got introduced a little bit earlier, and I've talked just a little bit, but now we're going to talk a little bit about the COMET program. I want to leave you with one thought up front, and the one thought is that COMET is about collaboration. Our collaboration is designed around bringing different people together to foster the geoscience education and the transfer of science to society around the globe. Last year, and every year for the past 3 or 4 years, we've had about 52,000 return users to the COMET resources. And those 52,000 users, there's approximately 6 hours of education that is completed by each of the people. And at the beginning of every semester during the academic year, there's 7,000 new users that come from colleges and universities around the world. We're about collaboration. We can't do this by ourselves. We were created in just before the beginning of the year in 1990 under a sponsorship by the U.S. National Weather Service and the Department of Defense. And that sponsorship has changed over the almost 25 years that we've been doing what we do. And our current set of collaborators or our executive board consists of the Environmental Service in Canada, the World Meteorology Organization, the Bureau of Met in Australia, the European Meteorological Satellite Agency, the U.S. National Weather Service, the National Ocean Service in the U.S., NESDES, the National Geodetic Survey, DOD, Department of Interior, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We've grown, we've diversified, but the key thing is we're promoting geoscience education. We're looking for new collaborators to continue to expand the portfolio. This is the size of the program. Right now we have 24 permanent staff. It costs about $4.3 million to open the door. This year we're sitting already with booked assets of $6.2 million, and there's another $600,000 to $800,000 that's coming in. And that's forced us into a new structure where we're doing something we call the 60-40 model. And in our 60-40 model, we have permanent staff that's based around our core and reliable funding. And then we have a surge staff that's made up of casuals, temporary workers, retired civil servants, retired faculty. And we bring everybody in so that we can continue to foster the science education. And it seems to be very effective. Now, the key to the fostering of the education is built around this 360 leadership diagram, but basically we combine instructional design and media services with the latest in technologies and with the latest in science and tie that to the requirements of the constituents that we're trying to train. There's a lot of things that are going on right now coming out of the World Meteorological Organization and coming out of the U.S. National Weather Service that is indicating that it's time to start moving toward a new competency-based structure for education and training that is going to lead us down a path that's much different than the way we've done things in the past, where we had knowledge, skills, and ability as separate entities, where now we're going to have to bring knowledge, skills, and abilities together in some kind of a demonstration of what you're going to do as you translate that science either into the workforce or into some kind of an application or into decision making. It's that knowledge, skills, and abilities of that competency set is going to lead you to different applications of the science, and we have to develop simulations and things like that that will lead us to those applications, and the training must be designed to support the applications. Our long-term success is driven off of a balance. We got to balance the quality and the efficiency, and that's done through equal partnerships with science and instructional design, and then continuous collaboration with and partnership with the academic community and the sponsors. And then we have to stay flexible because everything is changing, and it's changing rapidly. And the things we did last year are not current anymore. So we're constantly looking at new ways to innovate and to bring in new instructional design techniques. And we're right now doing a lot of work where we're pushing those all the way back into the university classroom. We just took and did a demonstration over the last about 4 months that was sponsored by the Bureau of Met in Australia, where we took the QG Omega equation and built an applet for demonstrations and laboratory exercises in the classroom. We just posted it to the website. We're in the process of working on about 41 more types of applications, and we're gathering the indications of how we're going to do that from the syllabi that are being used by the member institutions. And we're looking for common themes and threads so that we can pick up on those to build the right sets of tools that will be applied in the workforce so that we can have demonstrations that can be integrated in the classroom. This is our instructional design services, and this we believe is a niche in the distance learning environment, but we also see that as academic institutions are starting to move toward their 10-year future that's going to be a little bit more flipped classroom, a little bit more applied, a little bit more badging type systems as the for the students as they move out with specializations and certifications, that this classroom boundaries are going to become seamless between academia, the workforce, elsewhere. So that puts us into a different collaboration space. We're also moving down that road. We're working on needs and gaps analysis because as you move into competency space, it's performance-based. There's an outcome. There's a performance outcome or an application outcome. And you need to understand what that application outcome is when you want to decide whatever the educational media process is that will lead them to be able to demonstrate that competency. Another thing that we're doing is we're working on very high resolution media elements because our future workforce is the video game generation, and they demand a media architecture for their learning environment that's different than the traditional PowerPoints with the professor's scribbles on the sides of the PowerPoints that are his notes that he's going to talk about in class. They want an interactive media element, so we have to figure out how we put those, you know, into both the classroom and the professional environment so it's familiar and it's something that they continue to work with. Another thing that's a big demand is topic videos. We used to call them performance aids back in the early days of instructional design, where you would actually have a little sheet that they pulled out of a binder and it would remind them of what they were supposed to do or what the science restrictions were of something that was going to be applied in the workforce. That's all video. That's the demand now. We need to take that to video. So we're developing video services to meet that need. We're currently working on, this is our media designer, Steve Deo. He builds the Disney quality graphics that you'll see that come out of our modules, and he's working on one right now to where we're translating some science that was done between the ESRL laboratory and the NCAR laboratory, where they did an experiment around a wind farm, and they collected a bunch of high-resolution vertical profiler data that actually tracked over a significant period of time what the wind flow patterns looked like when they went through the wind farm, and there were multiple profilers and so on and so forth. We're actually animating that into four dimensions so that you can actually see how the wind profiles change as they move through the media or through the wind farm itself, which will then drive to a much quicker translation of that information to the students. The growing capacity. We are building a lot more instructor-led classrooms experiences, but they're different than they used to be. We're right now working on a new project with the U.S. Department of Interior and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where we're actually teaching water resource management impacts under climate change. and it's a professional competency group that we're working on. And what it's designed to do is teach water resource engineers how to adapt for climate change and what the key indicators are. The RAL, the Research Application Laboratory at NCAR, is doing the science. We're translating that science into education, and they are leading us down a path to where they want cost recovery to refresh the materials. So we're going back through and learning how to do cost recovery for the materials, and then we're also working on engagement with professional societies. Professional societies do their education and training as part of short courses. They're requesting that we translate the material that we created for the Department of Interior into short courses to give it to professional societies. And so in the 2015 AGU conference, we'll be working to prevent some short courses. We're going to work with the Geophysical Society of America, and that list will continue to grow. We're continuing to do the engagements, and the idea is we'll do cost recovery for refresh of the content as things modify and change. As I said, we're diversifying into the short videos. The demand continues to grow on this. We've moved into the YouTube channel. We've got a series of videos on climate change. We've got a series of videos that are on geospatial intelligence or information services, and the list is continuing to grow because that is the demand signal that's coming out of our sponsors. They want to start the training events with short videos that are 3-5 minutes long that talk about the topic, introduce it, can be used to explain it to resource sponsors, and then the actual deep dive into the instruction is a much shorter and separate module. Okay, we talked about the MedEd website. We're currently at 750 plus hours worth of instruction. We continue to grow in French and Spanish, and we just went over 300 and about 75,000 users. Like I said, we have 52,000 that come back every year and do over or almost 6 hours worth of instruction. And again, we have 1,500 universities worldwide. This is the distribution percentage-wise of what they look like. And you can see who the big user is. It's the university community. And we have U.S. agencies where it says not identified. There's a lot of private sector folks in that section. It's because it doesn't give them enough granularity in the way we set the database up to determine what they're going to do or how they want to design or identify themselves. These are our recent comet lessons. Several of them have been sponsored by Canada. The conveyor belt in identification in particular, and the future. This is the last slide. In comet, you can see on the left, that's our set of services as they stand now, and on the right is the set of services we believe that we are going to have to move to, and the way we're going to move toward that set of services is we're going to work with our sponsors and figure out what kind of demonstration things that they're willing to do as we step through the process, and we're going to change a little, test a little, change a little, continue. We're going to continue that process over the next 10 years so that we can try and keep up with the changes in the delivery that's going to occur. We're looking for more university partners to work with us as we do this, because we see that the future sector is more seamless, more collaborative, and as academic institutions get spend a little bit more time under stress for resources, we will provide more services to help you. Questions? Yes.
John. So I notice on the previous slide that you mentioned accredited content.
Yes.
So what do you think the direction is of Comet in terms of potentially offering, I'm not sure if this is a degree program or how that might impact or relate to residence universities? offering programs?
Well, we're currently in the middle of two things that are associated with this accrediting process. One of them is we're getting certified as a provider of continuing education units under the International Association of Continuing Education and Training. And that is focused on the professional workforce, you know, following their academic experiences. Then, separate to that, we're working on integrating COMET-type content with academic institutions into their delivery of instruction into either certificate programs or, you know, parts of their degree programs, and the academic institution will continue to be the credit-granting authority, but there will be a relationship there on how we work with that, because it appears that the national sovereignty on granting credit at the academic level needs to be maintained, and so we're going to honor that and work with the actual academic institutions within the countries to, you know, to continue to provide support. To answer the question, sir.
Yeah, I'm having a bit of trouble understanding this model. It's a very good model. You're trying to get lots of stuff free to everybody who could access it. Mm-hmm. But that limits you in getting funding in the future. At the moment, it seems to me the push is, if I get everyone in the community interested, they're going to push the government will give me more money, and therefore I'll keep my funding coming. But that's not the way of the future. I think governments are going to be backing out of supporting organizations more and more. They're going to be saying, go into big business, go to private funding. If you're giving everything to everyone free of charge, then they're not going to put their hands in their pockets and give you $5 or $10 to keep it going, because they're going to say, well, I've got it all free of charge. So I'm just wondering how you see this feeding back to actually getting funding for atmospheric research in the future. The push at the moment seems to be, you know, force the government to give us more money, but I see that as a bit of a dead end. Really, you've got to be putting the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gates and people like that to put in money as well. And I'm just curious on the financial model here.
Well, we can talk about, let's dive into that just a little bit. Our sponsors have dictated to us to go out and look at cost recovery for our collaborations with various types of users. And the way we're approaching that is that, say, for instance, we're working with the academic sector and there's something, you know, in the that we provide as a service. Either we build laboratory exercises or we do, you know, build animations to be used in the classroom or whatever. We're going to do a demonstration this year with the University of Oklahoma about charging lab fees. And that's one of the things that we're going to do as a cost recovery, because that puts us into a little bit more of a crowdsourcing process and puts us into collaboration with the universities that are going to use it. Other things that we're going to work on is that if we take we reconfigured our website last year as we went in to put in more redundancy, and we built it to where we can provide products and services at different levels of access. And so the idea is that if you want to come take the content for free, okay, come take the content for free, but if you have to prove to somebody that you completed the content, you need a transcript service or you need whatever, similar to what other MOOC-type universities have done, we are going to charge for the certificate for the training. Now, we have it segregated to where our actual long-term traditional sponsors can be treated with, you know, open access for all their workforces and so on and so forth, but the target that's coming from our executive board is to find ways to increase the amount of revenues that we can bring in from, you know, crowdsourcing or external users of the content through different levels of access. So we're doing those demonstrations this year, and we anticipate that we'll go back in and give a brief on that with our executive board this coming year, and they'll give us a little bit more direction as to where else they want us to fine-tune. The key thing that I think that this will lead to is at least the existing content will get refreshed and updated to the current media elements. I've done a lot of business analytics on the process, and I understand from the business analytics I've done that it is possible to go out there and charge small fees in the competitive market and draw enough retail to go back and do refresh. Yes.
Yes, you've mentioned a wide array of performance-based learning techniques, web-based, topic videos, flipped classrooms, and interactive media, and that you're teaming largely with the academic sector in order to advance this type of education. Are you teaming with anyone to evaluate their actual effectiveness in replacing more traditional modes?
Yeah, we're working with the university, our UCAR Community Programs Evaluator, and part of our next year applications is that we're going to run Kirkpatrick up through level three on certain stuff that we are doing in the new mode, and we're going to tag our traditional sponsors. We've already been talking to them about going in and actually evaluating at the application level with the workforce to make sure that we're not losing value in the process as we move it out into applications, and that process kicks off 1 October. So.
Okay.
We're going to have a panel this afternoon. We'll continue the discussion.